Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and today we will talk about China's innovation progresses and bottlenecks. This episode is part of Bruegel's focus on global China as seen from Europe, which includes our monthly newsletter, Zhonghua Mundus, which we have the link to subscribe in the show notes, as well as the Horizon China Research Project. I'm happy to host both Alicia Garcia Herrero, which is our senior fellow here at Bruegel, and Robin Skindowski, who is a research analyst at Bruegel, both working, Alicia and Robin, on the Horizon China project. And they are the authors of a recent paper on the topic of today's episode. How are you, Alicia and Robin?
Very well, thank you.
Very well as well.
This is the first podcast for Robin, so this is particularly exciting for us to have him with us today. While with Alicia, we obviously have all the podcasts of the China series together, so she's a long-standing staple for The Sound of Economics. Back to the topic of today. As we have seen in our previous episodes, the Chinese economy is at a crossroads. The investment-driven growth model on which the government relied for the last four decades is running out of steam. Fiscal deficits are widening and public debt is rising. Furthermore, population aging is becoming more visible, and the pandemic had some scarring effects which have taken a toll both on consumer and business confidence. The very rapid rise in wages since the global financial crisis is pushing China to move up the ladder in its production capabilities so as to be able to be productive enough to continue to raise wages and avoid the middle income trap. Pressure on the economy is further intensified by the recent increase in geopolitical tensions and fears of decoupling between the United States and China. Against such challenging backdrop, the central leadership is doubling down on its push towards a new type of development philosophy, on one in which the consumer demand and indigenous innovation serve as two pillars for further economic progress. Alicia, in one of the papers which we have discussed, you have been speaking of the challenge of China to defy gravity, and an innovation-centered economy could mitigate the structural deceleration of China's economy. And the central government is centered around an innovation paradigm dubbed as holistic innovation. What exactly it is, such an holistic innovation, and how it's being implemented?
China, as you said, is drumming really this idea of innovation at the center, not only of economic growth, but also basically at the center of its freeing from U.S. containment. So basically innovation for China has two objectives. We're going to focus on growth here, but I just want to say that innovation is important in itself for China. And I think the idea of holistic innovation goes in that direction, that you need it anyway, that you need it everywhere, that it should be pervasive in every sector that could become a bottleneck for China. So the paper we published recently on innovation really focuses on what you just said, which is mitigating structural deceleration. And what we find is that inputs are there, inputs to innovation, i.e. research and development, intermediate goals such as patents and scientific research is there. But the ultimate goal, which you really need if you want to mitigate structural deceleration, i.e. total factor productivity, or to make it very simple, productivity, is not yet increasing. So this is a big puzzle for China. Are they doing the right thing? Are they not doing the right thing for the ultimate goal? Again, forgetting about the additional goal, which might be, again, national security and avoiding containment from the US.
Absolutely. I mean, what you are bringing to the fore is really the productivity puzzle challenge. And I would say and would ask Robin, which are the potential bottlenecks constraining the translation of all this effort on innovation into this improved total factor of productivity?
Yeah. So in the paper that we've written, we find altogether three potential bottlenecks that could constrain China's ability to become more productive. The first one is market distortions due to an excessive involvement of the state, especially of local governments, and the collusion of local governments with business elites and with real estate developers in particular. This also stretches into finance. In the second bottleneck, we find there has been a kind of a loss of vitality among the Chinese youngsters. Youth unemployment is now at 20% still after the reopening of the economy. And for many, many youngsters, it's not easy to find a job in something else than the old manufacturing jobs. They have very high expectations. They want to have these good jobs in the tech sector. They want to have a good life, buy an apartment and, you know, or start a family. And for many of them, it's kind of hard. And this comes especially at a time when there was a tech crackdown and tech firms have laid off a lot of workers, which explains to an extent this rise in youth unemployment. And then, of course, the third bottleneck that we find could potentially inhibit China's productivity growth is US technological containment. I mean, we're talking about semiconductors, but increasingly we're also talking about access to finance from US investors, which has been rumored around the US government and which could potentially increase the pressure on the Chinese economy in this setting.
Thank you, Robin. And I think that we could, Alicia, go a little bit more in depth into these three bottlenecks. Perhaps we can start from the first one about the halt to the reform process, which has been mentioned by Robin. And can we say something more about the current institutional frame and how it can be a stumbling block?
Actually, there is a lot of, there's no single consensus view on this, I have to say. And Robin and I have been talking about it, because on the one hand, you hear, China, because of its kind of central planning, and it might be much more productive or effective in innovating because it can plan ahead and, you know, something we can't do as easily. On the other hand, though, one realizes that we need the right market environment to innovate. So private innovation or private sector innovation might be more effective, etc. And therefore, it is not very clear. So we are just putting that as a question mark in the paper. Is this really the reason? We know, and this is not us, but, you know, if you look at World Bank, NDRC, very, very famous report, Innovative China, that's the title of a report years ago, they do claim that China's long-term growth will be lower without reforms. And the idea being reforms, and this is like the reduction of the state in the production, so the role of state-owned enterprise sector won't help. But I have to say, not everybody agrees with this. So I want to leave it up there, you know, for further research. Is the state helping innovation or not?
We are going to explore also this in a specific case studies with the electric vehicles, for example, but this will be a matter for another episode of our discussion. The second bottleneck that you speak about, Robin, young people, unemployment, and the overall social pressure that China is going to face or is already facing. I mean, we're saying the youth unemployment stands at over 20%, even after the full reopening of the economy. What shall we expect on this regard?
So I think to an extent, this problem of youth unemployment is connected to the institutional framework and to the lack of reform of this framework. So what is happening in China in the 1990s is that there has been a tax sharing reform in 1997, where the central government basically diverted some of the tax revenues from local governments into its own pocket, and then started to sharing this tax revenue again with the local governments, but often in very nebulous bilateral negotiations, which created an insecure flow of tax revenues for the local governments. And so what local governments started to do is they searched for alternative sources of taxes, and they confiscated land from farmers, sold it to real estate developers, which created GDP growth in their jurisdictions, and also local government revenue. But it created these huge market distortions where workers basically moved from more productive sectors into the relatively unproductive construction sector. And this has created a kind of vicious cycle in which young people find it increasingly hard to enter the market, also because local authorities are searching for alternative tax revenues, not only in the construction sector, but also through various means of imposing arbitrary fines and taxes onto small businesses, and therefore creating a kind of atmosphere that is not very conducive to entrepreneurship. So a couple of years ago, Li Keqiang was citing one of the complaints that his government was getting of a young graduate who studied in Beijing, and then he wanted to go back to his hometown and open a small bookstore. He bought a couple of books, he opened the store, and everything was set up. And then the local tax authorities came and said, well, your windows are not complying with the regulations. And by the way, in this area of the city, there's another tax that you have to pay. And in the end, the young graduate had to go out of business, losing all his money that he has collected in order to start the business. And this is something that happens in a lot of parts in China. Less so in the East Coast, where the business dynamism is still kept, but more also in the center and in the West.
I see. And Alicia, we spoke about a third block bottleneck, which is the geopolitical situation. This is something that we always mention in each of our episodes, and we come back to that in several different forms. This time to highlight how the rivalry between the United States and China, especially the push of the United States to contain China technologically, could have or might have a negative bearing on China's ability to move up the ladder in certain key sectors, most notably semiconductors. How do you put this element within the frame of this wider puzzle that we are trying to compose?
So again, no consensus here, because for some, the US is only pushing China to innovate faster, i.e., it's just in a way helping, ironically, for China to, if not mitigate growth, which we don't really know whether they will have, it will have an impact on productivity, but at least to, again, reduce the bottlenecks as regards the US technological frontier. And others think that it will work, I mean, that it will delay China's moving up the ladder, because the type of semiconductors that the US is basically gridlocking for China are those that are basically advanced enough to be essential for, say, artificial intelligence, let alone quantum computing, but even, frankly, military, for example, supersonic weapons. So there's this idea that for China to really be up there, even military, this specifically the chips ban in from October 2022 onwards, because we also have the agreement for Japan and the Netherlands. And some people argue that because we just had this news that Taiwan and South Korea will not follow. This is actually incorrect. Taiwan and South Korea will follow for what is not below 7 nanometers, meaning it will still help the containment. And in that regard, my view is that, yes, it will delay China's moving up the ladder.
So all those, plus I would like to ask a more broad question on that, because I think that these overall challenges, some of them, they are country specific. So definitely China is trying to move out and defy gravity, defy the middle income trap and so on. So this is like very specific to the country. But then when you mention about the challenges of combining innovation with productivity, this is something that also in, let's say, Western economies has been debated in several different ways since a few decades. We've been always, and we are still debating about how much and to what extent technology is actually really having an effect on productivity. And even, let's say, without putting the country-specific in the equation, there is a huge debate about the relation between innovation and productivity. So from that point of view, I would like to maybe ask you a question that goes beyond your paper, which is specifically on China. But like, what kind of lessons do we learn on this more general debate on the relation between innovation and productivity, which also we as Europeans and in general, you know, global economy as such should take into consideration, because this is something that we are debating without considering all the geopolitical stuff. Also, when we debate about the role of AI, the role of robots and so on in our economy. So this is not such a new, to me, such a new debate that you are putting on the table.
Yes. So actually, in a seminar we held to present this paper with other speakers, I found it very interesting that we did hear from our discussants, Robin, that actually we don't see any increase in total factor productivity anyway, exactly, because of innovation. And if you add to that the fact that our innovation is increasingly capital intensive and not labor intensive, we should wonder, why are we all pushing for more innovation if at the end of the day, it's neither producing growth nor jobs? Yeah, and I think this is a big, big question that is not only an issue for China, but it's a global issue. But then it brings me back to geopolitics. Why? Because at the end of the day, if you want to secure global dominance, independently on whether you want to mitigate structural deceleration, you need it. And that, I think, is the key answer why at least US and China are pushing. And you see that very clearly in our paper. The US is speeding up R&D expenditure as much as China is, but at a higher level. So it's over 3.8% of GDP, which is humongous. And China is already at the EU level. The EU is just starting to increase, to your point. It's not really like out there, you know, spending like crazy on R&D. The US is, and China is, guess why? They are in this strategic competition. So I think that's the main answer.
Well, and if I may say, you also answered partially to my next question, which would have been about the role of Europe in all this, because somehow you are being a little bit bleak about which is the position of Europe in this competition, which is definitely not just about containment, but it's about dominance.
Yeah. I would only argue that, okay, so if I stretch my argument, one could argue why spending innovation, if anyway, you know, it's not bringing growth or jobs. But on the other hand, what if the others do and you don't? I mean, in that kind of game theory, who's going to lose the most? Because you might not still create growth or jobs, but you do achieve dominance, as you said, and you create strategic dependencies. So, you know, in a way, you're coming down in the list as to what you can do with your own market. And I think that's why we Europeans, in a way, we need to follow on this R&D expenditure, not because we believe that's the one and only answer. It's because we actually don't think we have it. I don't think we have a choice, basically.
Okay, that's something that brings us to our wider topics, and we are definitely going to get back to some of those, both the race for innovation of China, as well as the consequences, as well as the very important point of the EU strategy in all this, and what exactly it means, economic security and de-risking, which is something that is talk of the town at the moment. Unfortunately, however, we have only a limited time for this episode, and that's all we can discuss today. So I would like to thank both of you, Robin and Alicia, and I would like to remind our listeners that the paper of Robin and Alicia is available on our website, www.bruegel.org. And I would like to as well remind that all our analysis from our scholars is available always on our website to read in open access over there. So, Robin, Alicia, thanks a lot for joining this conversation, and thanks to our listeners for following us. Until next time, bye-bye.